You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, we've got a lot coming up today. Does studying economics produce greed? We're going to get into that in our second hour. And Ari Rabin Havad is going to be with us in our third hour. This new book, The Benghazi Hoax, basically outing Daryl Issa, who is actually 1 point behind a generic Democrat in his district. MoveOn just did a poll. And, you know, it's just amazing what these Republicans will do to try. The whole Benghazi thing is to try to damage Hillary Clinton, you know, on the premise that she's going to run for president in 2016. So just, you know, the whole thing is just astounding. There's new information, or at least new to me, about why the Obamacare healthcare.gov website isn't working. I wanted to share that with you. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Dick Durbin and Social Security and the Social Security scolds and this major enterprise that Pete Peterson and others have been pushing for decades now to destroy, basically, Social Security. And how Dick Durbin just walked right into this, sadly. I mean, he's one of the really good guys in the United States Senate. And so I want to discuss this in a way that I hope is respectful, the way that I would do it if he was sitting in the room here with me. But let's start with the Obamacare thing. And, you know, there's a couple of pieces to this. And once again, by the way, if you've had an experience signing up for Obamacare, a good experience or a bad experience, feel free to give us a shout and share your story with us. I also want to get into, there's a brilliant piece in the New York Times today by Amiya Srinivasan called Questions for Free Market Moralists. It basically blows up libertarian theology, libertarian philosophy. I want to share that with you as we go through the day. So there's a whole lot going on. Just to begin, just to kind of close a loop from yesterday. Yesterday, a fellow by the name of Tom from Colorado called, from Eagle, Colorado, and said that his cell phone was dead, and so he was using Skype to call us. And he said that he's currently paying $564 a month for his health insurance. He's a 57-year-old non-smoker. And he went on the Obamacare exchanges, he said a plan with comparable coverage to what I now have is $838 a month. So his cost of insurance would go from $564 up to $838. Now, everybody else who called yesterday said they would see their cost of insurance go down. So, you know, I kind of trashed him on the air saying that I thought that he was just, you know, calling because there we had this California phone number saying I thought he was calling from, you know, somebody was paying him to call or something. So he sends me this long, very personal email, which I'm not going to read on the air. I respect people's privacy and confidentiality. But, Tom, if you're listening, I think I've figured out why you were quoted a price that was roughly $300 more than you're currently paying for roughly the same health insurance plan when you get it from Obamacare. And it's because the Obamacare plans require you to cover your dependents. And in your letter to me, you said, my current premium is $564 a month. I am a 57-year-old non-smoker, and there are three dependents in my household. I am the only one in need of health insurance at this time. Well, here's the thing. If you sign up for Obamacare, it's not just going to cover you. It's automatically going to cover your dependents as well. It's going to cover, I'm assuming this is a wife and two kids or three kids. It's going to cover your spouse and your children. So, or, you know, there's ways around that, and this is why you should call an Obamacare navigator. So basically what the website was offering you, and you said you make enough money that you don't qualify for any of the reduced amounts, any of the subsidies, so that's cool. So basically what it was offering you was you for 500 and change a month, and each one of your three dependents for $100 a month, which is a pretty good deal. So I would encourage you to dig into that a little further. I have, and thank you for the for the email explaining that you weren't a troll. I appreciate that. But I think that you're misinformed. Or maybe I am. I don't know. But, you know, it's just there are going to be those cases where people are going to find, you know, anomalies where the price has gone up. But I think typically they're going to be cases where people have dependents and their dependents are not covered or not adequately covered, and they will be covered now. So who knows? Maybe kids who are like, you know, under, what is it, 24, 26, 20, kids who are under 26 who, you know, you don't have on your policy, Obamacare will try to put them on your policy. Maybe you can get them off. Who knows? So check it out. But with regard to the Obamacare program, you know, why is this thing not, why is healthcare.gov working? Turns out, you know, I was pointing out that I've been through several conspiracy theories now, and I think I've finally figured out what's going on. Not that any of the theories that I had before didn't make a certain amount of sense. Number one, that some states were not setting up their own exchanges, and so the federal government got stuck with the job, and that's not really what they signed on for originally. They were going to be a Google-like portal and just send you out to the states, but now they're doing it for 36 states. That still makes sense to me. But do you remember RIGO 1 and RIGO 2? RIGO 1, you probably don't. These were during the Clinton administration. RIGO 1 and RIGO 2 were an initiative that Bill Clinton called Reinventing Government. And this did not start with Bill Clinton. This started with Ronald Reagan. The brand name Reinventing Government started with Bill Clinton, but and Clinton was very enthusiastic about this. But it really started with Reagan, this idea that government workers can't do things well. Now, what's really driving this is that government workers are typically union workers. Right now, there are about 250,000 fewer people who work for the federal government today than there were the day that Ronald Reagan left office. And yet, our economy has grown by, geez, I think about a quarter. Our population has certainly grown. Government has, you know, the job that government does has grown, and our federal budget has grown. So what happened to those workers? Well, it turns out that they got outsourced. People, I can tell you a story. Somebody I know who was a computer programmer working for a state. And, I mean, this is somebody I know quite well who was working for a state and making a reasonable salary with pension and benefits, you know, state worker, unionized, the whole thing. Republican governor comes in. All of a sudden, him and all his friends in his programming pod get laid off and then hired the next day by a company that's been started by a buddy of the governor's. And their pay is pretty much the same, maybe a little bit less. Their benefits aren't as good. But the buddy of the governor is charging far more than they're being paid for their services. It turns out that this whole reinventing government thing, Clinton cut 17% of the federal workforce in his 8 years and bragged about it, was quite proud about it. So we've moved at least 300,000 jobs out of the public sector, which has a 36% union membership rate, into the private sector, 6.6%, which gets us to healthcare.gov. Healthcare.gov is screwed up because it was outsourced. It was sent out to a whole bunch of private contractors who are skimming all this money off the top. They should have done it the way that NASA, you know, put a man on the moon, or the Manhattan Project. You build a team within the government.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There are some things that government actually does better than private industry, and those are the things that have to do with not making a profit, like making sure that people get health care. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Nate Sweet is on the line with us. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Producer with the big picture. So our size of government, instead of the size of government, we should be talking about the cost. I was just getting started on that rant here. Just a minute ago, I'm going to get into it in a little more detail. But I'm going to start out with that, and then we're going to have our big picture politics panel.
Yeah, but I mean, we're going to start out by talking with our guests. We got Huey Newsom, Christy Setzer, and Mark Harold on the program. Sort of a classic politics panel. All of them have been on the show before. They're all great. So we'll get their thoughts on what we should be doing to really reduce government waste. I'll be interested to hear Huey and Mark's perspective, because conservatives are always talking about reducing waste, but the policies that they support to reduce waste actually increase waste. So yeah. It's an interesting situation to hear them.
But it does kill unions.
Right. And that's the real purpose behind it, I think.
I think that that's a big piece of it. I really, really do. Ari, he's going to be on our radio show in the third hour here today, too. Ari Rabin-Havad, am I saying that right?
Yeah, he's going to be here talking about sort of the Benghazi hoax that's been concocted by the right-wing media from Media Matters. So he definitely knows his stuff about right-wing conspiracy theories in the media.
Yeah, yeah. Shano tells me it's pronounced Ari Rabin-Hoft.
Yeah.
So he's going to be with us about the, you know, what this. It's amazing. It's like the Republicans can't win elections without fraud and deception. I mean, you know, it's whether it was Richard Nixon blowing up the negotiations for the peace in Vietnam in 1968, whether it was Ronald Reagan negotiating with the Ayatollah to keep the hostages in 1980, you know, whether it was George W. Bush having his brother knock 80,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls in Florida and then still having to go to the Supreme Court. I don't think that a Republican has won the White House since Eisenhower, legitimately. And, you know, the Republicans did not achieve, did not get a majority of votes for the United States House of Representatives. They lost it by 1.5 million votes, and yet they can maintain control of it through fraudulent gerrymandering. And now they're talking about changing the way that electoral votes are allocated in the states. You got three different states, Florida, Michigan, and someplace else.
Pennsylvania,
thank you. That are talking about, you know, assigning electoral votes based on congressional districts rather than the entire state. And, you know, which might not be a bad idea if the whole country did it, but if only red states do it, it means that, you know, every president in the future is going to be Republican, even though they didn't win the national vote. This is just crazy. Anyhow, another day, another school shooting.
Yeah, Jennifer Hope from the Moms Demand Action Group is going to be on to talk about that, what we can do to prevent these sort of actions from coming again. But by the way, you know my conspiracy theory about Benghazi, Tom?
What's that?
I think Vince Foster was behind it.
Ha! Yeah, of course.
He was behind it all. The Clintons sent the ghost of Vince Foster to wipe out the State Department employees.
Well, actually, Vince didn't kill himself. You know,
right.
Maybe he's one of the lizard people.
Yeah,
you know, David Icke's lizard people, and he just put on a different human suit.
Yeah, and harp weapons too.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what's behind it all.
Yeah.
But anyways, moving on to to our daily take, we're going to be talking about how the Koch brothers are sort of the robber baron kings of the 21st century. A little history lessons going in there as well to see some sort of echoes of this from the past. There have been people like the Koch brothers before in American politics, and Mark Twain's had some interesting things to say about them.
Mm.
So all that's going to be in tonight's Daily Take.
Very interesting. 20 minutes past the hour. Nate Sweet, producer of The Big Picture. Thank you, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll be right back. So here's the bottom line. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Here's the bottom line of how it worked and what happened. You know, back when we needed to build a nuclear bomb, or at least we thought we did, that's a whole different argument for another time. But back when we decided to build a nuclear bomb, before Germany did, and they were working on one too, we did the Manhattan Project. And the Manhattan Project, I believe that there were some private contractors that were involved with it. But it was principally people working for the government. We put a man on the moon, you know, Jack Kennedy. We're going to put a man on the moon within this generation or within a decade. We did it. And, there's that famous joke from John Glenn when he was Friendship 7, when he was the first man to orbit the Earth, you know, or the first American to orbit the Earth. And they said, what were you thinking when you were sitting on top of that capsule? It was about to blast off. And he said, I'm paraphrasing from memory. I may have the number wrong, but he said, I'm sitting on top of 10 million individual parts, each one sourced from the lowest bidder. But government did it. You know, government put it together. We do things well. Government does things well in the United States when they have to do with the commons. Our fire departments, our police departments, to the extent that, you know, NASA, the Weather Service, I mean, to the extent that it has to do with the commons, and there's no reason or need for a profit motive to be involved, we do things well. So why have we outsourced our voting to the voting machine companies? Why have we outsourced the healthcare.gov website? You know, the CGI company that got the initial contract, it was initially a contract for $93.7 million. So far they've taken $292 million. Instead, what President Obama should have done is, instead of spending all his money on the contractors, because, you know, they're going to skim money off the top. I mean, look at Medicare versus any health insurance company. Medicare operates on a 3% overhead. The health insurance companies operate on a 20, 25, 30, 35, 40% overhead if they can get away with it. Because they skim money off the top for their CEOs. You got Stephen J. Hemsley out there with United Healthcare having taken over $1 billion out of his company, as did his predecessor, Wild Bill, what's his name? Dollar Bill McGuire. You've got over 100 executives making over $1 million a year in the health insurance industry. You've got dividends that they pay to their stockholders. I mean, you know, all that's got to come out of our pockets. So it's the same thing with any contractor. So if you're going to build a website for the federal government, for the healthcare.gov, what they should have done is they should have hired a team of 100 programmers and put them rent some building space in D.C. or someplace. You know, it could be done pretty much anywhere in the United States. Why outsource it to a Canadian company, for goodness sake? I mean, we even sent the work overseas. We didn't even keep the jobs in America. This makes no sense to me. But here you have five presidents in a row. You got Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, George Bush Jr., and now Barack Obama, all continuing down this road of privatizing public functions so that they can say, oh, I shrank government. No, I shrank government more. No, I shrank government. I mean, Bill Clinton holds the record, right? Of how many federal workers got laid off. Well, what happened was those jobs got moved out to private for-profit corporations. Those private for-profit corporations then started taking more money. I mean, this is why the federal budget deficit is going up in part. They start taking more money, and then what do they do with some of that money? They kick it back to the politicians. This is not good. It's not smart. It's not wise. Joshua Holland wrote a great piece over at BillMoyers.com about this. It's called Healthcare.gov Debacle, Spare Some Blame for Bush and Clinton. And there's a great piece by Moira Herbst in The Guardian. The real story with Obama IT woes is out of control private contractors. You know, there are a lot of things that the government actually does better. Reagan said the government is not the solution to your problems. It is the problem. He was wrong. It's time for us to admit 32 years of Reaganomics was wrong. Reagan was wrong. Okay, now I promised you I was going to mention Dick Durbin. Dick Durbin said, must have been on Fox, yeah, because he's talking to Chris Wallace. He said, Social Security is going to run out of money in 20 years. I want to fix it now before we reach that cliff. If we don't focus on the health care and dealing with entitlements, the baby boom generation is going to blow away our future. We don't want to see that happen. Dick, excuse me, Senator Durbin, there are two reasons why Social Security is going to, well, first of all, it's not going to run out of money in 20 years. What's going to happen in 20 years is that it's going to have only enough money to pay 70% of benefits, which is still a hell of a lot of money. But there's two reasons for this. The first is that so much of our national income, you know, has moved above the 1%. People are making more than $130,000 a year. There, you know, not a lot of people, but a small number of people are not just making over $130,000. They're making over $1 million, over $10 million, over $30 million, over $1 billion. You had 10 guys on Wall Street last year who made over $2 billion each. After the first $130,000, they pay no Social Security tax. The middle class, which pays all of their income, they pay Social Security tax on all of their income because the middle class makes less than $130,000. The middle class has seen their wages flat for 32 years, ever since Reaganomics. That's the main reason why Social Security is going to run low on money in 20 years. So you just lift the cap. That's really simple. And the second is that because Wall Street crashed, you know, because Ken Lay got Wendy Graham to get Phil Graham to deregulate the banks back in 99 and 2000 in the Clinton administration, the banks crashed, and so people have less money to pay in taxes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, Senator Durbin, please don't insult our intelligence. And if you live in his district, you may want to give him a call at 312-353-4952. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, once again, Social Security is solid. You've heard Bernie Sanders say this, a thousand times in this program. Social Security is solvent for really the next 20 years, which means we've got lots of time to fix this, number one. It doesn't have to be some kind of grand bargain, this chain CPI, you know, any kind of cut to Social Security. Yesterday, Rich Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, came right out and said, any Democrat who works to cut Social Security, he said, we will not forget. We will work to damage your or to end your political career. Now, with regard to Dick Durbin, who's the second or arguably maybe third most powerful Democrat in the United States Senate and a very good guy. If I lived in his district, if I lived in his state, rather, in Illinois, I would call his office and say, I'm a big supporter of the senator. In fact, here's my email address and here's my home address. Put me on the list because when he's up for reelection or if he's got something important going on, I might even want to contribute some money. But please ask him to hold the line and not support any kind of cuts whatsoever to Social Security. The solution to Social Security, if you're going to do a solution in this legislative session, which is extremely unlikely because the Republicans control the House, but if you're going to do a solution to Social Security, it's not to cut benefits. It's not to chain the CPI. It's to lift the cap on the Social Security tax so that Bill Gates pays the same percentage of his income in Social Security tax as does the guy working at Dunkin' Donuts. It's real simple. So I would be very respectful, and I would, and like I said, I would say, and this is the truth, I support Dick Durbin. I think he's a good guy. But to go on Fox News and say, you know, this is going to be a disaster, you know, this kind of thing, this is like, you're not just playing with fire. Consider what happened in 2010. Starting in 2008, Democrats started also echoing, not all, but some Democrats started echoing the line, the basic line, about how Social Security was in trouble, right? In fact, this Richard Eskow wrote this. You can see it over at alternate.org. It's titled, What Are Democrats in the Senate Smoking? Caving into right-wingers to cut Medicare would be a political disaster. Dick Durbin's phone number, by the way, in his district, in the district, the 312 number is 353-4952. 353-4952. Richard Eskow, who's a very, very smart guy, he wrote, this is a recent poll by Lake Research. 82% of Americans oppose cuts to Social Security, which includes 83% of Democrats, 78% of independents, and 82% of Republicans. 74% of Tea Partiers oppose cuts to Social Security. So why would any Democrat want to commit political suicide? They need to be 100% united and hold the line on this thing, the same way Harry Reid and the president did on this government shutdown thing. Just say no. And then Richard goes on to point out, Democrats hold the advantage on this issue right now, which means it's theirs to lose. There is a historic precedent. In 2010, or a historical precedent, in 2010, after 2 years of presidential rhetoric about trimming entitlements, remember that the first 2 years of the Obama administration, President Obama kept saying, I'm willing to cut a deal that involves entitlements. And all of us kind of shivered and shook, but, you know, he didn't. But it made a lot of people nervous, okay? In 2010, after 2 years of presidential rhetoric, and we should be, by the way, calling the White House comment line and saying the same thing to President Obama. Take that off the table. Take that chain CPI off the table. Back to Richard Esko. In 2010, after 2 years of presidential rhetoric about trimming entitlements, Democrats experienced a 20-point plunge on the question, which party do you most trust to handle Social Security? Republicans responded to this with a thoroughly predictable, utterly insecure, and very effective Seniors Bill of Rights. Remember that? In 2010, they rolled out the Seniors Bill of Rights just in time for the election. And that was the year the Democrats lost control of the House of Representatives. Do you really want to go down this road? So, Senator Durbin, you're a good guy. Get your facts straight, please. Call Senator Sanders' office. He'll fill you in. I'm serious. Bernie has been on this topic for the 10 years that I've known him. He has been absolutely solid on this topic, and he knows the numbers. He can recite them from memory. This is a bizarre story, just apropos of this. And then I'll pick up your phone calls. I know the lines are, every single line is full here. The president of the Harlem Children's Zone said he's on the college campus circuit to gin up student activism around entitlement spending. This guy, Jeffrey Canada. You know, he runs, see, this is the so-called fix the debt campaign. This is a bunch of Wall Street billionaires. There's $2.7 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund. They want it. He says, there's a lot of folk who have a lot of money who simply don't need Social Security, and we can't even have a conversation about means testing that group. It's unfair to the next generation. Right. Let's means test Social Security. I mean, right now the Koch brothers are eligible for Social Security, and they're probably drawing it. I'm sure, you know, every penny they can get, they'll take. So they're probably both getting $1,000 a month or thereabouts from Social Security, whatever it is. And you say, Koch brothers don't need it. No, they don't. But if you start means testing, if you start saying anybody with an income over $70,000, over $5 million a year, can't get Social Security, then next year it'll be anybody with an income over $1 million a year can't get Social Security. And then the next year it'll be anybody with an income over $50,000 a year can't get Social Security. And then the next year it'll be anybody with an income over $12,000 a year can't get Social Security. And pretty soon Social Security has been turned into a damn welfare program. And you know what happens to welfare programs? Democrats like Bill Clinton come along and say, we're going to end them, end welfare as we know it. And, you know, he did it with the best of intentions, and it didn't cause a lot of damage during his administration because we were in the middle of this giant bubble. The economy was roaring. So he cut benefits back and time limited them to 4 and 5 years. But now that we've had a recession that's running more than 4 years, there's a lot of people who are really hurting because of what happened back during the Clinton administration. And let's give credit where credit is due. It was the Republicans who were pushing that stuff. Clinton just decided to sign the bill and take credit for it. But now we've got, you know, public education people pushing privatization of Social Security. I mean, this is nuts. And by the way, if you're listening and you're 25 or 30 years old and you're thinking, who's this old geezer talking about Social Security? I don't care about Social Security. I'm not going to, you know, I probably won't even live till I'm 65. One third of all the people taking Social Security benefits right now are under 65. They are people like my friend Michael Hutchison, who we did a eulogy on this program for a few months ago when he died, who back 15 years ago was running across, in his 40s, was running across a footbridge in New Mexico and tripped in the ice and fell into the river and broke his neck and ended up paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of his life. He lived on Social Security disability. There are people like young Paul Ryan, who when his dad died when he was a youngster, his mom qualified for widow's survivor's benefits so she could stay home and raise her kids. One third of Social Security recipients are people who have fallen on hard times. They're literally widows, orphans, and disabled people, which could be you tomorrow, God forbid, but it could be. Every single one of us has a multi-million dollar insurance policy, and the younger you are, the more it's worth. If you become totally disabled like my friend Michael was when you're in your 20s, Social Security over the course of your lifetime, and you live to be 80 in a wheelchair, Social Security is going to pay you a lot of money That's a big insurance policy that you've got for free because we're all paying into it. Let's not mess with this thing. So, end of rant. And like I said, I think Dick Durbin is one of the finest men in the Senate. And if you call his office to share your opinion of the chain CPI with him, please be sure to give them your contact information so that in the future, when he is running for re-election and is doing fundraising, you can help out. Not only will your words have more impact that way, but it's important to keep good people in the Senate. Anyhow, William in Clearwater, Florida. Hey, William, what's up?
Hi. I was listening yesterday, and the guy who said he was getting his care through the VA,
right,
and then said he had to go through all these different things to verify whether or not he would be covered by the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
I'd like to know where he got his information from. I'm a veteran. I get my care through the VA, and I get a letter saying that as long as I am getting my care through the VA, I have met the requirements of the Affordable Care Act,
right,
and I need do nothing.
Yeah, and that's the case with the vast majority of veterans. I'm guessing that fellow was some strange hybrid of a veteran. You know, maybe he had been a part-time National Guard member or something like that. That he might have qualified for some minimal VA benefits. I don't know, but I agree with you. I think that he was the exception rather than the rule. People who get veterans benefits, people who are on Medicare, people who already have health insurance through their employer, the vast majority of Americans do not qualify for, but do not need Obamacare. Obamacare is for the people, the Affordable Care Act. Thanks for the call, William. Well said. Obamacare is for the people who do not otherwise have access to health insurance, and particularly the poor and the working poor, and you can get it for virtually free if you're in those categories.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Especially free in those states that have taken the Medicare expansion. John Kasich just took this in Ohio, so you'll see that showing. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And EL in Tallahassee, Florida. Hey, EL, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Hartman. It's a privilege to speak with you.
Thank you.
And you have a very informative program. And my greatest concern was, you know, the registration for this Obama health care.
Mm-hmm.
And you did, you cleared some things up for me with the private contractors. I wasn't aware of that. But the websites, the billing, I'm concerned rather than not that, being that the Republicans, who knows that this thing's a failure, do not have contractors in there where they would put glitches, where there'd be a problem for the people to register or not.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it was sabotaged. I think what happened was you've got three different things that have to work together. You've got the federal government and its databases, you know, things like the Social Security and the IRS databases so that they can verify your income and your citizenship status. Then it's got to talk to the individual state that you're in. And in 36 of the states, the federal government is having to do that work. So the federal computer has to talk to the state computer, and the state computer might be on a different language. You know, I mean, this is like Fortran COBOL kind of thing. You know, it might be using a different computer language. It might be using different kinds of information. It might be tab delimited instead of comma delimited fields in their databases. I mean, there's all this translation of information that has to go on between the state and the federal government. And then the third one is the federal database has to interact with the health insurance companies. When they're all done getting all this stuff together, then they've got to talk to the health insurance company computers. And each one of the health insurance companies has a different kind of computer system. And so that is, you know, just a prescription for a disaster. I'm amazed that the thing is working at all. But the easiest thing, if you're having any problems at all, EL, the easiest thing to do is to just call, because there are people who, you know, they have access to the kind of the back end of the computer system, and they can just walk you through the program, or walk you through the system. And that phone number is over at healthcare.gov.
No. My question is that the contractors, shouldn't the contractors have been aware of this?
Yeah.
They was aware of this, and this thing that you would have no problem that different insurance companies in the states, et cetera, having this problem.
Yep.
That should have been the main.
Well,
thing
and here's one of the other problems, EL, and that is that they hired different contractors to do different parts of it, and the contractors are using different computers. This is why it all should have been done inside the government. They should have created a Manhattan Project group. You know, rent a building in Washington, D.C., and hire 100 of the best programmers in the country and you know, make them government employees with full benefits and say, okay, make this thing work. And talk to each other every day, you know, and interact with each other and walk from desk to desk and make it happen. But instead, they farmed it out to a company in Canada and to a whole bunch of companies around the United States. And now you've got all these private companies that, I mean, the original contract for CGI was $90 million contract. They've taken over $200 million now because they keep coming back saying, hey, we got an open-ended contract. We can just ask for more money. And it was done wrong, and it was done wrong because this Reagan philosophy is still alive and well in our government. In fact, I'm guessing that the legislation itself, which was written by both Democrats and Republicans, specified that private contractors would be doing this. You know, they certainly budgeted for it. And I think that's wrong. That's very unfortunate. EL, thanks a lot for the call. Well, good, excellent point. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with Jim in Las Vegas, listening on WCPT's stream at WCPT.com. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to tell you my great experience with the healthcare.gov. Mm-hmm. We have a Republican governor here. He's a moderate, and he embraced the partnership with the federal government here in Nevada. Mm-hmm. And the first day, October 1st, when everybody had all these problems, I went to I knew there were two websites for the state of Nevada because the governor was advertising it on TV and all, but I didn't remember what they were. So I went to healthcare.gov. What state you live in, Nevada, clicked on it. There came the two links, clicked on a link, put my information in, looked at the different options I had, got off, went back on about 3 or 4 days later, ready to sign up. And because I only made $11,000 last year, I got automatically pushed into the expanded Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. And I got dental insurance for $21 a month.
Wow.
I am so happy with that. I have high blood pressure. I'm 57 years old. Last year when I tried to get a health insurance, it was $880 for a single. I'm healthy as a horse, except for high blood pressure.
Right.
And now I'm automatically pushed into the Medicaid program.
Yeah. So that's great. So you've got basically free health insurance plus $21 a month for your teeth.
Yeah, it's great.
Not too shabby. That is great. Jim, thank you for sharing that story. And what your story does is it echoes my point from yesterday that healthcare.gov was intended to work like Google. It was intended to be a portal. And you say, I'm from Nevada, boom, it pushes you out to Nevada's site. But because 36 states said, nah, we're not going to build the sites, mostly Republican governors or Republican legislatures or a combination of one or the other, so nah, we're not going to do it. Now healthcare.gov has to do 37 times the work that it originally had planned for. And they're doing it now with private contractors, which, you know, ain't a good thing. So, anyhow, Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Yeah, I'd like to discuss Senator Durbin and the other Democrats who want to join Republicans and drink their Kool-Aid when it comes to changing Social Security, either through the chain CPI or by means testing, as Jeffrey Canada has suggested. I mean, this is such bad politics for the Democratic Party that could cost them seats in the 2014 elections.
I agree.
Coming up in the midterm.
It did in 2010. It cost them seats.
Yeah.
And the Republicans rolled out their seniors' Bill of Rights, you know, just to shove it in everybody's face. The President Obama and some of the Democrats were talking about, you know, the chain CPI, about reducing the cost of living benefits.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And that's in addition to this being such bad policy that will actually, I don't know if many people realize this, that it will actually, the chain CPI through lower cost of living adjustments and the Social Security checks, that will actually lessen the money in elderly and disabled people's monthly Social Security checks. the COLAs, these cost of living adjustments, are reflected directly in the monthly checks that everyone from Social Security receives. And we should make no mistake about it, that these lower cost of living adjustments from the chain CPI would mean less money in people's money.
Right, which is going to mean less economic activity in the economy, because people on Social Security, the vast majority of them, there's a small sliver of rich people who get Social Security, but that's pretty irrelevant. The vast majority of people on Social Security actually need it, and they spend all of it every month. And so if you increase their benefits rather than decreasing them, you're going to increase economic activity, which is going to put more people back to work. And if you cut their benefits, you're going to decrease economic activity. So it's not only bad politics, it's bad policy. And that's just it. Harold in Upland, Indiana. Hey, Harold. 92 years old?
God bless you, Tom. You're teaching the American people what it's all about.
Well, thank you, Harold.
I'm 91 years old, Tom.
I spent 2 weekends ago with a fellow who was 92 years old and sharp as a tack. I am so impressed.
Listen, I remember in 33 when about a couple corporations and bankers tried to impeach Franklin Roosevelt for raising their taxes.
Yep.
The last year I worked for General Motors, I paid $9,000 in on my Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, if any politician is crazy if he tries to do that, that's political suicide.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
My point.
I remember anyone who would want to vote for anybody with that attitude. And I love listening to Bernie, and I watch you every day.
Well, thank you, Harold. Thank you.
I just, Tom, I can't understand how anyone can think about tearing up. Well, Reagan tried to tear up everything that FDR done.
Yep.
And they're still pitching at it.
Yep.
And these people ought to realize that.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you, Harold, and that's why I'm saying what I am. Harold, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching the show, and thanks for the good words about Bernie. John in Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, first off, you mentioned Reagan a minute ago. I think he accidentally told the truth when he said the government's not the solution, government's the problem. Our government is set up to keep the oligarchy in power. So from that point of view, he was telling the truth, but I know he didn't mean it.
Well, I would say the Supreme Court is the problem, because the Supreme Court's rulings, I mean, Congress has passed legislation to try to stop the oligarchy. And, you know, for example, McCain-Feingold, keep money out of politics. And the Supreme Court blew that up with Citizens United. The Supreme Court, we have a constitutional monarchy now in this country, and it's not the way it was intended. Right. Anyhow, we have just a half a minute, John, for you to make your point.
My main point was this whole 17 days of the shutdown.
Yeah.
I didn't hear the Democrats, the Republicans, or any mainstream media mention the word uncertainty. And when they were talking about ending the Bush tax cuts, oh, they were screaming about uncertainty.
Right.
And this is orders of magnitude bigger.
Yes, absolutely. Excellent point. Very, very, very excellent point. And, you know, the Democratic ability, Democratic Party's ability to message is, you know, just needs to be fine-tuned a little bit. They should have been out there screaming every day, look at what this is going to do to the long-term economy. You know, people aren't going to be hiring people because they're uncertain. You're absolutely right. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, check out the 24 Hours of Reality, The Cost of Carbon. It's presented by the Carbon by the Climate Reality Project. It's 24 hours of music, interviews, information on the cost of carbon pollution and what you can do to help. The website is 24hoursofreality.org, 24hoursofreality.org. But it's, you know, the digits 2 and 4, www.24hoursofreality.org. And I think you'll find this really, really interesting. There's a link, by the way, on our homepage at tomhartman.com if you can't remember that. So just a heads up, something fascinating. I read an amazing piece over in the Huffington Post business section and the headline, does studying economics breed greed? And I thought, whoa, really? Professor Adam Grant, a professor at the Wharton School, in fact, the youngest tenured professor, and the author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, his website, giveandtake.com, A-N-D, giveandtake.com, is with us. Professor Adam Grant, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So does studying economics cause people to change their worldview and become greedier?
Well, I think it might. You know, I think my job as a social scientist is to take a look at the data. And there are some studies that suggest it's possible. We've got evidence that economics professors give less to charity than people in other fields. That they're also, if you've studied economics, you're more likely to say greed is morally acceptable and good. And you're also more willing to deceive others for personal gain and violate rules of fairness.
Now, is it possible that your line of causality is backwards? That, we know that, you know, about roughly 1% of our population are sociopaths, people who don't feel empathy for other people. And as you get closer on, and there seems to be some, sort of a spectrum of sociopathy, as people get closer and closer to that spectrum, they tend to be more into things, abstract things like economics, and less into things like, psychology or social work or something like that, that involve interacting with humans. Could it be that people who are dysfunctional in the area of working with other people who don't easily feel empathy but do easily manage numbers in their heads end up in the field of economics?
Yeah, I think my read of the data is that it's probably not either or, it's both and.
Uh-huh.
So there's evidence, for example, from Switzerland that students who chose to study economics were actually less likely to give to people in need at the start, even before they began studying economics.
Right.
But I think that doesn't mean causality can't also run in the opposite direction. And we've got some pretty neat studies that I think speak to the idea that economics training and education might actually tilt people more towards selfishness.
Well, I can tell you.
One way to do that, of course, is to track what happens to people as they take economics classes. And the evidence there says that the more time you spend studying economics, the more your values of helpfulness and loyalty and responsibility to others drop. There's also some evidence that after people take economics courses, people expect others to be more selfish. And as a result, they're more cautious and less generous because they think, look, if everybody's going to be selfish, then I've got to protect myself by doing the same. And two colleagues, Annie Malinsky and Joshua Margolis, and I actually did a fun study where we randomly assigned executives to just unscramble sentences with words about economics,
mm-hmm.
or neutral words.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found that when they had to deliver bad news to others, they actually expressed less compassion and concern if they had been exposed to those economic words.
Now, I remember back in the, I'm an old fart, and I remember back in 69, 68 or 69, taking an econ class. It was either at LCC or MSU, but whatever. And the professor, the essence of that class was Keynesian economics. It was, here's how we got out of the Great Depression. It was that the goal of an economy is to support the social structure around it, to support society. And economic decisions should be made based on their consequences and impact on society. When one of my kids was going through college and studying economics, and I remember this because, he would come home and say, here's what the professor said today. And I'm like, pulling my hair out. Really? It was clearly not a Keynesian who he was studying. It was instead you know, somebody who was a disciple of the Chicago school, you know, of Hayek and what's his name, Friedman and company. And basically what they were being taught is that the ultimate value is greed, and that if everybody just acted in their own self-interest, everything would be fine. Could it be? I mean, if you look back at the history of economics, Adam Smith did write, you know, the Wealth of Nations, and there is that single sentence once in the book that's actually a cautionary note about the invisible hand, the marketplace. But he also wrote a book called A Theory of Moral Sentiments, which, you know, we had to read back in the day, but now kids don't even know exists, warning us about selfishness, warning us about laissez-faire capitalism. And could it be that it's not economics generically, but it's the type of economics that's being taught? I mean, you got the Koch brothers who are actually funding econ chairs at colleges around the United States if libertarian-leaning professors are put in those chairs.
Yeah, Tom, I think you have that exactly right. It's certainly not all brands of economics that have this effect, right? So there's evidence that learning about macroeconomics and political economics doesn't necessarily breed more selfish behavior, whereas when you study business economics, with a strong emphasis on sort of sole profit maximization, you're a little bit more likely to see that effect. And you know,
you've gotten that granular in your data.
I'm sorry?
You've gotten that granular in your data.
Well, I haven't, but a couple of economists actually have. So it's been really neat to be able to tease those effects apart, at least, you know, for starters.
Yeah.
And I do think it harkens back to Adam Smith, right? He wrote in The Moral Sentiments that how selfish soever man be supposed, there are some principles in our nature that interest us in the fortunes of others.
Right.
And we may get nothing from benefiting other people except just the pleasure of seeing them better off. And yet, you know, that may be a force that motivates us.
Yes.
And I think if we incorporate these principles into our economics courses, like we often do when we teach behavioral economics, we're in pretty good shape.
Right.
I think
it could be that
when we start to say, look, the resources are completely scarce and everyone needs to be selfish.
I have talked with a number of young people who have gone over to the libertarian side. They, you know, they were first attracted by legalized pot and legalized prostitution. And I've always referred to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. But these people, they get sucked into this whole, you know, the Ayn Rand thing and the whole selfishness, greed is good stuff. And they start, you know, talking about, well, cut everybody off food stamps, do away with Social Security, we don't need no damn social safety net, it should be the, and it's like, these are people who have never experienced genuine want, and it's almost like they're being trained to be sociopaths. Thoughts on
that? Yeah, you know, it's certainly a complicated puzzle, but I will say that, you know, if we go back to Adam Smith, right, he said, look, markets are imperfect, and there are going to be some problems that are not going to be solved by sort of naturally created systems that operate based on standard economic principles.
Right.
We normally call them externalities, right? And they can be both positive and negative.
Yep.
And so we do need some level of regulation to make sure that problems that are not easily solved through profitable mechanisms can be solved through other means, and I would certainly stand by that recommendation.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think it's important to note that his invisible hand comment, the beginning of that sentence has something to do with, it's been a long time since I've quoted it, but when it comes to the actions of nations or within the context of nations, I mean, it was qualified, and it had to do with things like, you know, it arguably was defending things like protectionist trade policies, but in any case, Professor Adam Grant, professor at the Wharton School, the youngest tenured professor there, and the author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, giveandtake.com. Fascinating work, and is the article still up over there at Huffington Post?
It is, yep. You
okay.
Can put it on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah, check it out. It's titled Does Studying Economics Breed Greed? By Professor Adam Grant. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great conversation. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So maybe we should be very careful about the kind of economics we teach rather than just economics. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sean in Greenville, South Carolina. Sean, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Well, thank you. I love your work. Well, I'm a chiropractor, and I'm a little opposed to the Obamacare as many of my colleagues are. We're more into, you know, natural health care, getting your spine adjusted to make sure your nervous system works 100%, eating healthy.
Does Obamacare cover chiropractic care?
Yes, it does, in a limited way.
Wow.
Still high deductibles.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have the pharmaceutical industry, they have one out of four children now on Ritalin or Adderall, and one out of four children once a week a child commits suicide from Ritalin or Adderall. You have the vaccines, there's a direct increase of the increased inoculations with increased autism. You have, you know, basically I'm saying that if we're forced to buy drug care is what it is, maybe they should include, like, people going to gyms, yoga, community gardens, herbs, massage therapy, et cetera.
Your statistics, you realize, are highly debated, highly contestable, although there are people who would assert what you just asserted. But I absolutely agree with you that wellness, fitness, things like that should be things that, if at the very least, if Obamacare doesn't pay for them, that you get a tax deduction for it. I mean, you know, I have a, Louise and I have a gym membership that we got after she had her breast cancer surgery, and we just, you know, figured, okay, we got to, and I had surgery too, and, you know, we got to get back into shape, and we thought of this as a medical expense, but it's a couple $1,000s a year. It should at least be tax deductible. You know?
Yeah, so, yeah, I agree. But, I mean, what is your feeling on Americans being forced to get this care here? I mean, the forefathers, I believe, were highly against anyone having to buy a product or service.
No, the forefathers were not against that. The forefathers actually, the first president to sign legislation using tax revenues, money from all of us. It was all, back in that day, tariff revenues, so sales tax, basically. But the first president to sign legislation providing for building a poor house, staffing it, feeding poor people, providing medical services to poor people, and clothing poor people. The first president to do that was George Washington. And George Washington was certainly cognizant of the founder's intent. He was one of them. He had three horses shot out from underneath him trying to create this country. The second president, John Adams, who was far more conservative than George Washington, a high Federalist, maintained that policy. Third president, Thomas Jefferson, maintained that policy and expanded it considerably, and then built the first free university in the United States so that anybody could go to college. He thought everybody should be able to go to college for free. And then the fourth president, James Madison, when he came in, one of the first pieces of legislation that came across his desk as president was a bill that Christians in Congress had passed saying that that poorhouse that George Washington had financed, actually it was a network of them, that the poorhouses should be run by the churches, and that the federal government should give the money to the churches, and the churches should administer the poorhouse. And that was James Madison's first veto. Google James Madison's first veto, and you'll get it. And he came right out and he said, this would set a precedent for the federal government giving money to churches, and that is something we should never do. So, Sean, I think your understanding of the founder's intent is a little off. They really did think this was a we society, not a me society. They built a country for all of us, where we all look out for each other. We built barns together. Look up barn building sometime. We're back at the Tom Hartman program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no, no chance. Neither is ExxonMobil or anybody. Anyhow, to understand the present, you have to understand the past. Which brings us to this fascinating story of a guy named William A. Clark. Now, for our listeners in Montana, you know who I'm talking about. Clark was one of the copper kings of the late 1800s in Montana. He made millions in the booming mining industry. He tried his hand at the electric industry, this brand new thing that Thomas Edison started, the newspaper industry. He owned banks. He owned railroad lines. He was involved in a lot of business. He got really, really rich. And then he decided, hey, let's run for political office. Be a big shot. I want to be the senator. He had this lifelong ambition of becoming an elected official and of getting the fame and power that came with it. So in 1899, the election of 1900, right? In the election of 1900, he wanted to be a U.S. senator. Now, back then, U.S. senators were not elected by we the people. That was an amendment to the Constitution in the 19-teens, the 17th Amendment. Back then, U.S. senators were chosen by their respective state legislators. So one afternoon, Clark walked into the Montana State Legislature and announced that he would be standing in the back of the room holding envelopes filled with $1,000 bills. And he said he'd give those envelopes to anyone who voted for him to be their senator, to represent them in Washington, D.C. And enough legislators voted for him and took his money that Montana sent him to Washington, D.C. as their senator for the 1900 legislative session. But William Clark's bribery scheme, this was so public. I mean, he was just right up front about it. He stood back there waving the envelopes. The newspaper reporters got... It was so brazen that even the largely corrupt U.S. Senate was horrified, and they refused to seat him after reading newspaper stories about his passing out these $1,000 bills to get elected. In fact, it was the notoriety of Clark's naked bribery attempt in Montana, which was well-reported in newspapers across the country, that helped lead to the passage of the 17th Amendment, which said that we the people get to elect the senators instead of bought-off state legislators. So with all this notoriety, Clark pretty much became public enemy number one in the early 1900s. Mark Twain, yes, Sam Clemens, good old Mark Twain, wrote about Clark, quote, "He is as rotten a human being as can be found anywhere under the flag. He is a shame to the American nation, and no one who has helped to send him to the Senate who did not know that his proper place was in the penitentiary with a chain and a ball on his legs." Now, he died in 1925, but his willingness to corrupt the American democratic and political process is alive and well today. I mean, seriously, just look at the Koch brothers. David and Charles Koch are worth an estimated $68 billion, and they're among the driving forces behind the corruption of our democracy. Between 1998 and 2008, Koch brother-controlled foundations... They're not passing out $1,000 bills in the back of the room. They gave more than $196 million to organizations which favor policies that would pad the wallets of these two brothers in that same time period. Koch Industries, owned by the two brothers, spent $50 million on lobbying and handed out $8 million in PAC contributions. Kochs are also behind groups like Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works, which both gave and continue to give major financial support to the Kochhead Tea Party movement. And Freedom Partners, a Koch-affiliated organization, has doled out grants worth over $230 million to a variety of conservative organizations, Tea Party groups, and front groups that oppose Obamacare. Which brings us to the Keystone XL pipeline. This is incredible. Recently, the Koch brothers have been throwing their billions at lobbyists, front groups, and lawmakers who support the fossil fuel industry and the construction of the Keystone pipeline. They are the fossil fuel industry's largest donors to congressmen and women who sit on the committee that oversees the Keystone XL pipeline. In 2010 alone, the Kochs and their employees gave over $300,000 to members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. This is the committee that oversees the Keystone pipeline. At the same time, Kochs have given more than $60 million over the last 15 years to groups that deny climate change. So why are they doing this? Why are they handing out money to people who support Keystone XL pipeline and support America's toxic addiction to fossil fuels? Simple answer. It's going to blow your mind. Money. And lots of it. According to a new report released by the International Forum on Globalization, the Koch brothers stand to make up to $100 billion in profits if the Keystone XL pipeline is approved. Keep in mind, these two guys are only worth $68 billion. This could double their net worth. The report found that the Kochs and Koch Industries hold up to 2 million acres of land in Alberta, Canada, which is the proposed starting point of the Keystone XL pipeline. And many Koch industry subsidiaries are going to make millions on the pipeline's construction, including Koch Exploration Canada, which is going to profit from oil exploration on its land, Koch Supply and Trading, which would benefit from the trading of oil derivatives. I mean, they're looking at a $100 billion windfall down the road. That's more than double their combined fortune today. So, surprise! They're doing everything they can to make the Keystone XL pipeline a reality. I mean, look at back just last week. The Republicans in Congress tried to use the Keystone XL pipeline as leverage in the government shutdown, demanding that it be approved. Yeah, you got to approve this or we're not going to raise the debt ceiling. Right. Meanwhile, you and I are stuck with the byproducts of the Koch's relentless pursuit of money and power. Koch Industries is already one of the top 10 polluters in the United States, pumping millions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere each year, driving global warming and climate change. And if the Keystone XL pipeline is finished, it'll make things even worse. Synthetic crude oil from tar sands generates three times the pollution of regular crude oil and is very poisonous. I mean, just small leaks in this pipeline could be catastrophic. So today, the ghost of William A. Clark is alive and well in the form of billionaires like the Koch brothers who are corrupting our political process while destroying the environment and poisoning us. We really shouldn't continue to let the likes of modern-day William A. Clarks continue to buy off the American political process. And for information on how to fix that, go to movetoamend.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And movetoamend.org, because it's the Supreme Court that has allowed the Koch brothers to do this by saying that money is speech. We can amend the Constitution to change it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we were talking earlier about Senator Durbin's comments about Social Security running out of money, as if he was kind of speaking like the president that, well, maybe chain CPI, I don't know. I mean, he didn't literally say that, but, you know, I was suggesting that you might want to call his office and let him know your thoughts on this. Senator Mark Warner said something very similar on CBS's Face the Nation. He said, we all know at the end of the day, Democrats are going to have to give on entitlement reforms. Now, this was the kind of rhetoric we were hearing from the president in 2008 and 2009. And what happened in 2010, the Republicans passed the Seniors Bill of Rights and they won back the House. Sheldon Whitehouse, Tammy Baldwin, Bernie Sanders, Peter DeFazio, there's a lot of good people on this. Senators Warner, Wyden, Patty Murray in Washington State haven't yet said exactly what they think. And I just wanted to get Congressman Peter DeFazio on, one of the smartest guys in the House of Representatives, one of the leaders of the House Progressive Caucus, and somebody who's been talking about Social Security for years and years and years and knows this topic inside out, to share his thoughts with us. Congressman DeFazio, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks. I think it's almost 20 years since Bernie and I introduced a bill in the House to lift the cap on earnings, which, of course, would provide more money than Social Security would need forever. I mean, think of those top 10 CEOs today who average, $40 million each. Can't remember. I think it was $40 million. Just think if they were paying Social Security on those earnings and the company was matching them. Think of the money that would flow into Social Security Trust Fund. Instead, they want to take away benefits from seniors who are on food stamps and having a hard time making ends meet. This chain CPI is not benign. It's destructive. I've got a chart. Don't have it with me. I'm driving in from the airport, but shows how many average week's worth of food seniors would lose every year you move out into the future because of the chain CPI.
Right, and the chain CPI is particularly going to hit people who are just signing up for Social Security.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's already been a change, two changes in Social Security that are major, the so-called notch, which people talked about for years. Well, the notch reduced everybody's future benefits, not just people who fell into that notch. So you're already getting a lower rate of return, if you have it, or a lower replacement rate on Social Security when you retire currently. And, of course, retirement age has already moved up to age 66. I keep hearing Morning Joe saying, we should move it up to 66. Well, Joe, you were there when we voted to move it up to 66, I think. So
Yeah. You've
already made some major changes in the benefits to penalize the average working folks who are dependent on Social Security. 40% of seniors are principally dependent on Social Security, and the chain CPI is not a good thing for those folks.
Yeah, very, very well said. And another point, we're talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio, who so ably represents, I believe it's the fourth district of Oregon?
Yep.
The Another point that needs to be made for those people who might be listening to us right now who are not over 65 and are not even close to 65, who are in their teens or 20s or 30s or 40s, is that fully a third of Social Security payments go to people who are not retired. They go to people who are literally widows, orphans, or people who are disabled. My friend Michael Hutchison, who was running in New Mexico one day in Santa Fe, hit a patch of ice, flipped over a bridge, fell into a river, broke his neck, and he spent the rest of his life. He just died a few months ago. He spent the next, almost 20 years living, as a quadriplegic, living on Social Security. This is an insurance policy for every American, and it actually is a bigger insurance policy for young people than it is for old people.
Yeah, I would challenge anyone. I have people come to my town meeting and say, I can do better. Just give me my money. Right. Well, I had a guy who was going to come and stand up and say, actually, you can't. And here's the reasons why. Because you're not just getting a retirement benefit, which is guaranteed, rare thing these days. You're also getting, as you put it, a full life disability, full life survivor's insurance. Try and go out and buy annuity with an insurance policy that matches your Social Security, and you'll find out it costs a heck of a lot more.
Yeah. Exactly. So the simple solution, first of all, Social Security doesn't have a problem. It's solvent for the next 20 years, and it'll pay 70% of benefits forever after that, and some say even 27 years, although Dick Durbin, I think, said 20 years on TV this weekend. But so we don't have to deal with this tomorrow. It doesn't have to be some desperate part of some grand bargain or any other kind of nonsense. But in addition to that, if we simply said, I find this bizarre, Congressman DeFazio. Why is it that only people who make under $130,000 a year, you, I'm sure you know the exact number. I'm sorry, I don't. Only people who make under that have all of their income taxed on Social Security. And anybody who makes anything over that, the millionaires, the billionaires, they pay not one penny into Social Security after that first $130,000.
Yeah, think of it this way. I think the current limit this year is $112,800. I can't keep up, but
okay.
It's adjusted every year. So at $112,800, you're paying full Social Security 6.4%. Now, if you earned 10 times that, you would pay 0.6% of your income into Social Security. It's essentially, it's a regressive tax on people. And, if you want to, and there are all these people running around about flat taxes. I even went to the Ways and Means Committee with this guy, Archer's chair once. I said, Mr. Chairman, do you like flat tax? He said, right. And he said, but this is the hearing on Social Security. And I said, that's right. Here's the solution to Social Security. Let's have a flat tax on all income. And he just about choked.
But it's so common sense. I mean, the president could even call it a flat tax, and I think he would be politically bulletproof if he did. Yes, we're going to turn Social Security, the Social Security tax, into a flat tax. Most people, the 90% of Americans will be completely unaffected by this. 96% of Americans would be completely unaffected by it, and probably wouldn't even know what he was talking about. They'd just think, oh, yeah, okay, so he's a middle-of-the-road guy. And, only the millionaires and billionaires will realize that a small sliver of their income is now going to be taxed that wasn't taxed before, and Social Security is solvent forever. How can you guys in the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives and the progressives in the Senate get the rest of the Democratic Caucus in the House and Senate to message this?
Well, how can we help you? Well, I've tried different things. And the president said he wouldn't tax anybody below $250,000 income. Bernie and I introduced a version of the bill, he in the Senate, I in the House, that said, okay, we'll leave the current caps at that point. I think they're 108. Between 108 and 250, you won't pay anything more, but over 250, you'll pay on all the additional income. That didn't attract his support, even though the president had supported this concept when he ran against Hillary Clinton, that we should lift the cap. If it comes down to they're going to sell out Social Security recipients with a changed CPI, then I think people will start listening to our message. Wait a minute. If enough seniors and enough people who know what this means for seniors start to raise a ruckus about it, then maybe we'll finally put in play a sensible solution. Let's take Social Security off the table. Let's fix it forever. Just make it a flat tax on all income. And now let's move on to bigger problems like Medicare and other things.
Right. I think that flat tax meme is one that really, really could go a long way. And I'm going to start talking about it like that. Instead of lift the cap, which people don't know what you're talking about, just say turn Social Security into a flat tax. Everybody pays the exact same percentage, regardless of their income. And and you know, I could pull quotes from Ronald Reagan out for that. Amazing.
I like that.
Congressman DeFazio, thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for fighting the good fight. Thanks for knowing these things. Thanks for, you said 20 years ago, you and Bernie introduced the first.
I think it might have been 95. It's like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it was
18 years ago. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You,
fighting the good fight all these years. Yeah. Congressman Peter DeFazio, his website, defazio.house.gov. I have that right, right?
Yep.
And you know, please check it out. And Congressman, thanks again for being with us and for the great work you're doing.
Okay, thank you, Doug.
Great talking with you. Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, one of the best guys, seriously, one of the best guys in the United States House of Representatives. Wow. Okay, Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, thanks for listening to AM 950. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Well, it's Congressman DeFazio stole some of my thunder.
He's a hard act to follow.
I have actually read the Greenspan Commission report, which in 1983... doubled the amount being paid into Social Security for both by both employers and employees to pay in advance for the boomer generation.
That's right.
They noted in there that it would not quite make it up, and they expected Congress to make an additional adjustment to that withholding to make up for the shortfall that they said was going to occur around 2035. Now, and it's out on the Internet, so you can find it and you can read it.
Right.
In addition to that, I think it was Alan Greenspan himself, when he came out and he said he thought people were more honorable than that, he thought that, you know, it wasn't just the market thing, that people, that the whole Ayn Randian thing, that people, he thought people were more honorable. He didn't realize.
Yeah, when he said oops.
So,
you know, his new book out now, he's taking back his oops.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh. At that point in time, he said something to the effect that they had not anticipated the huge rise in CEO salaries that was going to occur, or in that top 1 or 0.01%. And so the calculation that they made as to how much more income each year you should have to pay Social Security tax on was really skewed.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's because during the Reagan administration, after they, quote, fixed Social Security by doubling the tax on working people but cutting taxes on billionaires, they also changed the compensation rules to allow CEOs to be paid with stock options, you know, capital gains tax, the whole thing, and which has led to this explosion of income. Carol, thank you for the call. Plus, they dropped the top partial tax rate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But Carol is absolutely right. And oddly enough, the boomer generation is the only generation that is being double taxed for Social Security. They're not only paying for their parents' retirement, but for their own. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Diane in Raleigh, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to talk about the Medicaid issues here in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all about our wonderful legislature and our governor here.
Yeah, they've turned down the money, haven't they?
Yeah, but it gets even more interesting because when the governor was running and they just kept saying, Medicaid's broken, Medicaid's broken, Medicaid's broken, and then the state did an audit after his administration came in. They completed the audit. And it turns out they kind of fudged a few things on the audit. And this actually was reported the day before the state Health and Human Services director had to go before the legislature to answer questions about the problems they're having over there. And so now it's like they were trying to privatize Medicaid. And the woman who was actually running Medicaid quit her job a few months ago and has taken a position in Florida with a for-profit managed care company, which was going to bid on the Medicaid contract in North Carolina. But now it's like,
whoa,
they fudged the numbers, and then she wanted to take over the Medicaid program in a for-profit way. And I am just floored by all of
that.
Yeah. You know? So
that's incredible.
Really,
do you think that they might do like, I think as Arkansas did, where they say, okay, we will take the money, but we're going to run it through a private corporation that can skim a profit off it before we distribute it to the people? And that might be this woman who went to Florida?
It's very possible, but the thing is, since this came out about the record being fudged and everything, and them not looking at the program in an honest way, even Republican legislators who have like rural districts that would get really shortchanged because the rural hospitals wouldn't get the money that they need,
right,
they're actually thinking maybe the privatization isn't going to work. We haven't heard much from the governor or Health and Human Services about the report that came out about a month ago, and they still just say Medicaid is broken, but yeah, it really isn't.
No, it's just that they're turning down the federal money that would make it work really, really well in North Carolina.
And North Carolina actually does it quite well to begin with, so they want it privatized, and that's it.
Well, I'd say there's two pieces to the agenda, Diane. Correct me if you think I'm wrong. One is there's no public function that these guys don't think some private person should be able to make a buck off of. So yeah, they want it privatized. But in addition to that, they any government function that might benefit people, if they can break it and then blame it on the president and say, see, you elected that guy and now, you know, you're losing your Medicaid benefit. They think that people will blame the president for the system not working.
Actually, that happened on Ari Ravenhoff's show. A woman called in from North Carolina and complained about the Medicaid system, and saying it was Obama's fault, Obamacare's fault, but it was actually a state issue that she was having a problem with.
Did the host correct that caller, or was that just a propaganda call?
It was a propaganda call, but yeah.
Amazing. Diane, thanks so much for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV on your Roku box there in Raleigh, North Carolina. Much appreciated. We'll be right back with Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, to check up on what's going on in the world today. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of the goat and the person you helped. And the photo will probably be taken by Ellen Ratner herself, who's on the phone with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you. Before I start, I want to apologize. I wrote an article about your great last hours, and I talked about oxygen rather than methane. I usually don't make those kind of mistakes.
Well, that's okay.
Occasionally I do.
It's easy. It was an easy mistake to make.
But it is an amazing video film, and I suggest everybody go see it. I've been telling everybody.
Thank you. That's at lasthours.org. Thank you, Ellen, for the plug.
Okay. Guess what? When I saw this come over my little email, because I get all the Justice Department special things today, I thought, oh, my gosh, there's only one person for this. Diebold or Diebold, depending on how you pronounce it. Remember, those are the folks that brought you those voting machines.
Mm-hmm.
They just settled with the Justice Department for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They bribed government officials in China and Indonesia. They falsified records in Russia so that they could provide ATMs in the country.
Whoa.
$50 million.
So,
to pay the justice.
So the company that is running our voting in the United States, our privatized voting, I mean, it's bad enough that they privatized the government, you know, the healthcare.gov website. The company that privatized our voting is so consciousless and corrupt that they're bribing other countries.
That is correct.
Amazing. Okay. What else is
there? I mean, I was just astounded. Okay. So your friend, Senator Lamar Alexander, I always say that. Whenever I say your friend, you know it's your enemy or somebody you don't like.
That's how they speak in this town. My good friend. Yeah, right.
He's going to introduce a bill. It's going to go nowhere, but he wants to make some press, requiring weekly reports on Obamacare exchanges. He wants to introduce that in the Senate.
Right, rather than monthly reports, so that they can wave bad numbers around
every week.
Yeah,
get more TV.
You know, something I just learned this morning, interestingly enough, is that you're not actually considered enrolled in Obamacare until you pay the first month's premium, and as you go through the sign up process, you go all the way up to the very end. Is like, do you want to pay the premium now, or do you want to wait until December, because it doesn't start until January 1st? And a very small percentage of people are saying, I'll pay it right now. I've got the money. But most people are saying, I'll come back on December 15th and pay the premium for January. So there's not going to be a lot of people who are, quote, fully enrolled until, you know, the last couple of weeks of December, even though they've jumped through all the paperwork. And that little bit of language is one of the things that the Republicans are using to say nobody's enrolled.
Because they'll say X amount has only been enrolled.
Right, right. It proves, you know, the old Abraham Lincoln, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
That's exactly right. Okay, so we have that going on. The other thing is that Congressman Elijah Cummings, he's the ranking Democrat on House Oversight and Government Reform, he wrote a letter to Darrell Issa, who's his chairman, and he said that Issa had sent a letter yesterday to the Office of Management and the Budget, and it was unfair and omitted some of the questions and answers that were actually asked by this committee, and one of the things that Issa's letter to Office of Management and the Budget implied was that this was political and that the decisions were only made for political reasons, etc. Well, Congressman Cummings said, hey, that's not exactly how it happened. And CGI, who was one of the six contractors, whatever, said that they never said that decisions were made for political reasons, and that is what Darrell Issa implied. So he just out and out skewed the truth so he'd get more press.
This is with regard to the healthcare.gov website?
That's right.
So he's ginning up his hysterical propaganda. He's left Benghazi and he's on that now?
Oh, he's big time on this. I don't think he's left Benghazi, but yeah. he's added this to his bag of.
Well, tricks. Thank God Elijah Cummings keeping him honest.
Well, Elijah Cummings is great for that.
Yeah.
Okay, the White House is bringing in somebody, and I cannot pronounce his last name, Jeff Zients. It's been said to me all day here. I'm at the White House, but whatever. He's trying to get the healthcare site to work. He's a former CEO in the private sector. He's going to become director of the President's National Economic Center Council in January, and he is in charge of that.
Hmm.
Okay, so that is going on that front. U.S. Capitol Dome is going to be restored beginning on November 2nd. It is a two-year project. There are 1,000 cracks in it.
Is this the result of the fracking earthquake that you and I were both here for a couple of years ago?
You know, that is a very, very good question, and nobody is asking about that.
Yeah, because they're redoing the Washington Monument. You can't ignore
that. Was definitely done because of this.
And now they're talking about fracking in our water supply here. Did you see the Washington National Forest?
I actually didn't see that.
Yeah, and the fracking companies are trying to get permits to frack in the Washington National Forest, which is like the sieve that cleans the water that comes into the city of Washington, D.C.
Well, pretty soon they're going to be fracking under where you and I both live.
Yeah,
okay.
Probably.
You probably have already talked about this, so tell me if you have. But as you know, there were some drone strikes that happened. There were two reports released, one by Amnesty International, another by Human Rights Watch, and to do with drone strikes in the North Waziristan area between January 12 and 13. And apparently there were incidents where a grandmother was killed. She was collecting vegetables. We know also the group that I'm on the board of Reporters Without Borders has talked about how this has gone, that it's very unsafe for reporters because they could just be the victim of a drone strike.
Right. It's got to be bizarre living in a place where some foreign country. I mean, can you imagine if Russia started dropping drone bombs out of the air and killing Americans?
We would be out of their mind. Now, by the way, I have not heard, speaking of out of their minds, I've not heard about Senator Kerry's discussion with the French, but we do know that's been an issue.
Yeah, they're a little upset with all the spying. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a great day. It is coming up on 5 o'clock here on the East Coast. We'll be right back with Ari Robinoff.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide on the Free Speech TV Network. Welcome back to our program. Ari Ravenhoft is with us. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters, co-author with David Brock of The Benghazi Hoax, a new e-book. And Ari is also the host of The Agenda weekdays at 6 a.m. on Sirius Progress Channel 127. The website, of course, MediaMatters.org. Ari, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So you have written this book, The Benghazi Hoax, that people can find over at Amazon.com as an e-book. It's a 99-cent e-book. Do you have versions also for Barnes & Noble and Apple?
They're putting those up now. They actually just take a technology being technology. Certain companies put up things quicker than others. So
I see.
Those will be available in the near future.
Cool. Okay, so the book is available over at Amazon right now. And it's called The Benghazi Hoax. Benghazi, of course, that city in Libya that where where a Foreign Service officer died, and his two bodyguards and, four Americans died. Tell us the story of, first of all, what happened at Benghazi that we need to know about in a capsule, and then how did it get turned into a hoax?
I mean, Benghazi is truly an American tragedy, and the tragedy is four Americans, Ambassador Chris Stevens, Sean Smith, who were both State Department employees, Ambassador Stevens, of course, being the ambassador to Libya, and then two security contractors who were former Navy SEALs, who was stationed with the CIA in Benghazi, the other who was actually on a rescue team that came to Benghazi to help get the survivors of the attack out. Now, as this attack is going on, Mitt Romney and his campaign issue a statement instantly politicizing this attack, and thus begins the Benghazi hoax. The attack is a real American tragedy. The hoax is Republican attempts to convert tragedy into political gain.
Now, from where I remember, Romney doing that and then being criticized for it and then kind of backing off and then trying it again. And, it was one of his perennial things. But it seems like the real water is being carried by Daryl Issa. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So Mitt Romney really starts this off. But as soon as he kind of does a Mitt Romney, i.e., flip-flops three times between six separate positions, Daryl Issa picks this up as his, he's finally going to get the administration. And
right.
His cohort, Jason Chaffetz, on his committee also kind of takes this under his mantle, and they're going to get the administration. And here's the thing. There are very real questions when an attack like this occurs that need to be answered. We need to make sure our diplomatic facilities are safe. That is a completely legitimate area for congressional inquiry. That's a constitutional duty, in fact, of Congress to hold the executive branch accountable in those situations. What's not a constitutional duty is attempting to make sure to go get the executive branch, to go on a witch hunt, to insist that all the evidence which suggests this is a tragedy, one which the Accountability Review Board, which is a legally mandated review process, comes back and says, here are 29 things we can do to prevent this in the future. And instead of saying, let's make sure the State Department is doing all 29 of these things, What that report didn't say was impeach Obama and Hillary Clinton is guilty. So then that report gets thrown out, and they don't care about actually preventing these attacks. This has been a witch hunt.
Right. Now, Daryl Issa, my recollection, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, and I don't know if your book goes into this. I just bought it online about 20 minutes ago, so I'm looking forward to reading it tonight. My recollection is that Daryl Issa is either the richest or second richest man in the House of Representatives, that he made his money selling car alarms that he now has manufactured in China, that there was an allegation that he had been involved in car theft and that he had burned down a warehouse to get insurance money to help start his company. And, you know, that's still kind of hanging out there. He has been arrested, apparently. I mean, this guy has a fairly dicey background, or am I mischaracterizing him?
Look, I think we don't really get into it that much in the book. We describe Daryl Issa as one of the wealthiest members of Congress and his car alarm business. But there have been a number of shady incidents you've gotten into, and I don't think you're mischaracterizing them.
Okay. So I'll stand with those. You don't get into that in the book. But why, you know, is Daryl Issa playing the role of a modern-day Joe McCarthy? I mean, is this entirely political? I remember, you know, when he took $1 million of his own money and was apparently collaborating when Gray Davis was governor of California.
Oh, he desperately wanted to be governor at that time.
Oh, yeah, and he threw $1 million into taking down Gray Davis, and he thought he was going to be the nominee, but what he didn't know is that Arnold Schwarzenegger had been having these secret meetings with Ken Lay at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and then Schwarzenegger comes out, and because Ken Lay had been doing these brownouts in California, which is what led to the end of the Gray Davis administration. And when Schwarzenegger announced, Daryl Issa in public broke down in tears. This is a very political animal here. Is when he was denied that, he's now, you know, in charge of this very powerful committee in the House of Representatives. Is he pulling a Joe McCarthy, or is he just, you know, a really diligent investigator?
Well, I think the comparison to McCarthy is really interesting. And I think here's what's interesting about it. The Benghazi scandal in general, what Mitt Romney tried to do, what this is all about for Republicans is proving something they think about Barack Obama, that he's the other, that he sympathizes with terrorists, that he's a secret Muslim. And while Daryl Issa will never make a comment like that, if you read the undertones of why would Barack Obama be sympathetic to terrorists, which is the undertone of that was the overt tone of Mitt Romney's argument, but has been the undertone of this entire investigation. You pick that up very clearly, that this is not just about four tragic American deaths and preventing them from ever happening again. This is about casting the president as anti-American.
Well, in this Foxosphere, it's, you know, that's fairly cleanly answered by a couple of simple declaratory comments that are actually true, that President Obama's father was black, was from Kenya, and was a Muslim. And, you know, case closed, right?
Right. And this is, if you look, in my last book with David Brock, The Fox Effect, we got some internal emails from Fox. And one of the most shocking ones to me occurred after Barack Obama gave his speech in Cairo, where internally the head of the Washington's news division, this guy named Bill Salmon, not a Sean Hannity, not an opinion person, a news person,
right,
sends an email around the entire Fox headquarters. And we got this email, and I looked and I was like, this is shocking, saying Barack Obama didn't mention terrorism once in his speech. And that became the meme on Fox, right? Barack Obama won't say terrorism. He goes on an apology tour. I mean, Mitt Romney's book was No Apologies for a reason.
Right.
There, you know, this is all about casting him as being friendly to terrorists. So why, when Americans were under attack, did Barack Obama not send in the troops to go get them? Well, that's the answer conservatives believe.
But in fact, he did send in troops. You said one of the guys who died was there to rescue the people who were under attack.
Yes, there was a team sent from Tripoli, first of all. Second, that night, troops were being repositioned all around the world, being flown to staging bases in Italy, being repositioned throughout the Middle East. And two other – don't take our word for it – two other authors who are not Democrats get into this in their book, Benghazi Under Fire, about these troops being repositioned around the world that night and the capabilities of the U.S. military, which have been discussed. The fact is every single person in Benghazi who was affected by this attack was evacuated within 12 hours. Every
wow.
single person affected by this attack was, including the bodies of all the dead.
Wow.
Every single person affected by this attack was out of Libya, flying to Germany within 24 hours. That's not leaving people behind. That's success.
So in the Foxosphere, they've just completely lied and distorted this thing, and Daryl Issa is continuing to do it. Ravenhoff, Ari, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
The book is The Benghazi Hoax. Hang on just a second. I'll give you more information.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's The Benghazi Hoax. It's available over at Amazon.com as an e-book right now. And, of course, at MediaMatters.org, you can find out more about it. Ari Ravenhoff and David Brock are the authors. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 15 minutes past the hour. And Jeff, watching Free Speech TV in Statesville, North Carolina. Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hey there, Tom. Just wanted to reinforce what you said earlier about contractors and their labor costs and their inefficiency.
Mm-hmm.
When you're referring to most labor contractors these days, I don't know what it's like in the past, but it's usually about three times what the actual labor cost is what the contractors are charging the customers. You know, and it's like that for my job, most everybody that I know.
Right. So when somebody is a government employee and they get laid off and then they get hired back by a private contracting company, this is sort of like, you know, Ed Snowden going to work for Booz Allen doing work for the NSA. Booz Allen was probably billing the NSA three times whatever Snowden's salary would have been if he had just worked at the NSA doing the exact same job.
Absolutely, and it's been causing our debt to skyrocket. So definitely something to look at if you ever, you know.
Yeah, and this is something that really began in a serious way during the Reagan administration. Clinton really expanded it dramatically, and then George Bush expanded it dramatically, and it's continuing to happen under the Obama administration. Although Barack Obama, when he first came into office, said he was going to get this contractor thing under control, it doesn't look like he's had the political power to do that, because these people take the money that they're making doing this with this privatization, and they spend that money on politicians.
And 66% of that price increase goes to the 1%.
Right. Yeah, of course. We've got, there's the, you know, the wealthiest county in the United States, or the wealthiest zip code in the United States, used to be Beverly Hills. Now it is just north of Washington, D.C. and Virginia. And, you know, it's where these 20 and 30 bedroom mansions are being built by these contractors, mostly defense and intelligence contractors, but all kinds of them. Jeff, excellent point. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Maureen in Warren, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Maureen, what's up?
Well, I'm going back to your previous show.
When we were talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio about how Dick Durbin is saying, let's cut Social Security with a chain CPI.
My son, who passed away a year and a half ago.
Sorry to hear that.
Was on Social Security for over 15 years,
mm-hmm.
dying of Huntington.
Oh, my.
And I had to leave my job of $65,000 a year and go down to $15,000 a year to go on Social Security myself to take care of him. And if they privatize Social Security, people aren't going to get help like I did.
Right.
Once he got into the nursing home the last 4 years, he switched to Medicaid.
Yeah. How old was your son when he first went on Social Security disability?
26.
And this is the message that we need to convey to Americans. You know, there's 26-year-olds who are saying, why are you bothering me with information about Social Security? Why should I care? It's only for old people. No, it's a full disability insurance policy that covers everybody from birth until death. And it's there for the 26-year-olds in the world. Maureen, thank you for validating my comments. And thank you for calling, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Warren, Michigan. We'll be right back. This is interesting. The White House said today there is no evidence that Obamacare is driving up the number of part-time workers. No evidence. Conservative Republicans keep pointing to this. And indeed, one in five businesses in the service sector think the program has hurt employment at their firm over the last 3 months. But the economic data is not there. The number of people with part-time jobs who went full-time, who want full-time work was essentially flat in September, 7.9 million. We're not seeing any change in the data, said a guy, Jason Furman, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Also, the number of part-time workers spiked in 2008, and that was because of the Bush crash. That wasn't because of Obamacare. I mean, Obama wasn't even president. He was running for office at that time. So, pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I get these conservatives on all the time who go, oh, yeah, it's all these part-time workers are coming because of Obamacare. It's no. Sorry, it's not. It's not because of Obamacare. It ain't happening. You're making that stuff up. Stop doing it. So, anyhow, Brandon in Altamont Springs, Florida. It says here you're a libertarian. Is that true?
I guess I'm one of those libertarians, those young libertarians who likes to get high and laid all the time. But
you're a Republican who wants to get high, and get laid.
Well, no, your comment earlier.
Oh, yeah, that's what I call libertarians. Well, you know, first of all, you wanted to speak to Social Security, and then I got a couple of questions for you.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Well, what did you want to say about Social Security?
Well, I make $68,000 a year, mm-hmm. and that takes about, Social Security takes about over $300 a month out of my paycheck.
Right.
And if I was to invest that on my own, I would end up more than $500,000 at the end of 35 years, which means I could withdraw about $4,000.
What rate of return on your investment are you anticipating?
I was 6 or 7%.
Really? You can make 6 or 7%?
Yeah, compound interest is an extremely powerful force.
It is, but not at 6. I mean, you know, right now, I don't know any place where, you know, unless you're really good at the market, and I have been playing with it a little bit, with a little bit of money for the last couple of years, and I've ended up behind. I mean, this is professional investors.
The Dow average, what is the Dow average over the past 30 years?
But you're talking about retirement money. With that same $300 a month, how much would it cost you to buy? Well, first of all, how old are you?
I'm 30 years old.
30 years old. Okay. So how much would it cost a healthy 30-year-old to buy a full disability policy that if you become disabled, if you're in a car accident, God forbid, and you end up in a wheelchair or something like that, unable to work, unable to earn a living, that for the rest of your life will provide for your living expenses, your medical expenses, and living cash and a stipend? How much do you think that would cost?
Okay. Oh, it would cost a lot, but this is where I think you give...
That's in Social Security. You're paying for that with Social Security.
But here's the problem, that the majority of Americans don't look at it as an insurance policy. They're
but a third of all the payments that Social Security makes is to people who are disabled, not retired.
I know, but my peers and my friends, they look at it as a retirement.
Right, because they're misinformed.
So nobody else is... So they don't go and save on their own. So they rely on Social Security to retire. That's why there's an issue. That's why this.
Well, it's a pretty thin retirement, Brandon. I would suggest that people should have extra money. Here's a couple of questions. I don't have you seen this New York Times piece, Questions for Free Market Moralists, by Amiya Srinivasan?
No, I haven't.
Okay, let me just ask you a couple of questions, because these are the suggested questions for somebody who is a self-described libertarian, and I'm just curious what your answer would be. Is any exchange between two people in the absence of direct physical compulsion by one party against the other or the threat thereof necessarily a free exchange?
I don't really understand what you're saying.
Okay, the core concept of libertarianism is that government should not be involved in the marketplace because in a free marketplace, people will decide what to buy and sell.
I know there's a role in government, and you know, I guess you wouldn't say I'm a total. I mean, I voted for Ron Paul in the primaries, but I mean, again, I'm more. I wouldn't say I'm a true blown libertarian, I guess you could say, but
But a libertarian would say yes to the, in answer to that question. In fact, would have to. There's these four questions. They would all have to be answered yes. That any exchange between two people that is lacking physical force or the threat of physical force is a free exchange. And the problem that I have with that is that it doesn't account for nature. I mean, what happens if you're a farmer and, you know, there's a drought and you are starving, and I come to you and say, fine, you're starving. I will give you food. Give me your children and your wife. You may choose to do that to survive, but is that really lacking compulsion?
Tom, I think we got distracted off what my concern is with Social Security.
Yeah, we did. But, you know, you said I've been wanting to talk to a libertarian for a long time, so I'm taking my opportunity.
Well, I know. But, I mean, I guess, again, my concern with Social Security is that people in my generation,
right.
I don't see people saving on their own for retirement.
And they're not buying disability policies either.
No, they're not.
And that's because people in your generation are wiped out.
There's two sides to every story, and you're not giving it the other side. And that is, you know, you should really also point out the fact that people aren't doing their personal responsibility and saving for retirement. And people are looking for Social Security as retirement. And
but the flip side of that, Brandon, is that more than half of the people of your generation don't believe Social Security is going to be there because they're listening to this propaganda nonsense coming out of Pete Peterson and his organizations.
I would not have a problem with the government saying, all right, Brandon, you're healthy, you have retirement, we're not giving you anything back out of your retirement. But I wouldn't have an issue with that.
Yeah.
But my problem is, make that known to everybody. Look, you're only going to get Social Security if you're disabled, not because you have depression. You know, stuff like that. There's so many issues I have with that.
Okay. All right. I got it, Brandon. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Actually, I would ask, you know, and I'll ask anybody listening, the question that Peter DeFazio asked. If you can show me where you get a better return on your investment and the insurance. Okay, let me I just have to rip on this for a moment. This is just such a brilliant piece in today's New York Times. The core belief of the Ayn Rand acolytes and the libertarians, the Ron Pauls and the Paul Ryans and the Cato Institute people, the core belief that they hold is that if everybody acted in their own self-interest 100% of the time in an absolutely free marketplace, that magically society would organize itself in a way that worked to the best for everybody. They might take out the word magically. They would say scientifically, right? But, you know, that's their belief. Now, it has never happened anywhere in the world ever that way. But they still believe this. It's an article of faith. And there's this absolutely brilliant piece in today's New York Times by Amiya Srinivasan. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. And she basically goes through this and talks about how, you know, like she quotes Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, saying that cutting food stamps is actually a moral issue. That there are, you know, that if you just left everything to the free market, then morality would reign because the free market is inherently moral. And by distorting the free market with things like food stamps, we're being immoral. So you get, you know, Jeff Sessions saying, you know, cut food stamps. And not just Jeff Sessions. I mean, this is the entire Republican caucus that passed the Paul Ryan budget, which doesn't just cut food stamps. It cuts Medicare. It privatizes Social Security. It does all these things. This is the budget that they're working out right now. So she asks these four questions that you would have to ask, and all of which a libertarian would say yes to. Okay, and here's the four questions. Number one, is any exchange between two people in the absence of physical force, direct physical compulsion, or the threat of it, necessarily free. Now, you'd have to, if you believe in a free market, you'd have to say, yes, of course. Okay, the second question is, any free exchange, now we're talking about adults here. This is why libertarians say they want to decriminalize drugs and decriminalize prostitution. Hey, these are free exchanges, right? Between consenting adults. Is any free, that is not physically compelled exchange, morally permissible? Again, you'd have to say yes if you were a libertarian, right? Number three, do people deserve all they are able to get through free exchange and only what they are able to get through free exchange? In other words, does the marketplace, this free marketplace, always reward people in a moral fashion? And does whatever people get, is that what they deserve? And number four, are people under no obligation to do anything that they don't want to freely do or freely commit themselves to do? Ayn Rand referred to that. Right? The virtue of selfishness. If you don't want to do something, are you under any moral compulsion to do it? So the flip side of that, to make it a yes question, would be, are people under no obligation to do anything they don't freely want to do? Yeah, they're under no obligation. So, and here is how she answers these questions. Okay, first of all, is any exchange between two people necessarily free? She says, suppose a woman and her children are starving, and the only way she can feed her family apart from theft is to prostitute herself or sell her organs. Now, there's no physical coercion, and she is choosing to take this action, so that's a free transaction. Really? This is the point I've been making for years with libertarians and objectivists on this program, is that when they say threat of force, they are completely ignoring the force of nature. Hunger. The need for shelter. This is why Franklin Roosevelt proposed, the Second Bill of Rights. Okay, the second question is, any free exchange morally permissible? So the question she asks is, okay, say I inherited a big plot of land, I've got a farm, and you've got nothing. And I say to you, work on my land for a dollar a day for a year, and you're sufficiently desperate that you'll take that deal. And because of your work, I'm going to get a crop that I'm going to sell for $50,000, but I'm only going to pay you a dollar a day. Is that fair? Is that moral? An objectivist or a libertarian would have to say yes. I think most of us human beings, though, would say no. Do people deserve all they're able to get through free exchange? Now, you'll recall Mitt Romney famously said, hey, take a risk, borrow money from your parents and start a company. Because he was the millionaire son of a millionaire. In fact, his dad gave him and his wife $1 million when they went off to college that they lived on. Remember Ann Romney talking about how tough it was just living on that $1 million? So basically what you're saying is that the market determines the value of something. And she points out Van Gogh, William Blake, Edgar Allan Poe, Vermeer, Melville, and Schubert all died broke. Was what they were producing worth nothing? And the flip side of that is, look at all these people who are members of the Lucky Sperm Club. They were born into wealthy families, or they were simply born, white instead of black, or black instead of black and disabled, or, with a high IQ instead of a low IQ. I mean, there's all these accidents of birth. And if you think people, everything that they get, they actually earned, then you're discounting all of those things. You're discounting the effect of racism. You're discounting the effect of ageism. You're discounting the effect of the difficulties and challenges that people have with low IQ or with physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, emotional disabilities, abuse as a child, all these things. You're setting all that aside and you're saying none of that matters. And I don't think that's a moral position. But that's how libertarians would have the world. Yeah, the billionaires deserve their billion. The poor person deserves to be poor. And number four, are people under no obligation to do anything they don't freely want to do or freely commits themselves to doing. And she says, you know, common sense morality, this is absurd. You know, suppose I'm walking to the library and see a man drowning in the river. I decide that the pleasure I'd get from saving his life won't exceed the cost of getting wet and the delay, so I walk on by. I made no contract with him. I'm under no obligation to save him. Now, in a libertarian world, that's how it would be. So let me just say to those of you out there who think that you're libertarians, that even Republicans who want to get laid and smoke dope wouldn't go this far. Libertarianism is a hoax. It is being perpetrated. It's being funded in large part by the Koch brothers. One of them ran for president on the libertarian ticket. It's being funded by billionaires, and libertarianism only works for billionaires or for multimillionaires. So wake up. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida. Hey, Umberto, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a very important question for you and then also a quick statement that I want to make. First of all, my question. All of this Tea Party, I guess, romanticism with Ted Cruz and their hopes that he would run for the Republican nomination in 2016, I have a problem with that because unlike President Obama, who is a native-born citizen, isn't Ted Cruz in this case, isn't he the foreigner? Wasn't he born in Canada? And correct me if I'm wrong, maybe my knowledge of American history is a little backward, but isn't it necessary for someone to be a native-born U.S. citizen to be able to run for the nomination of any political party and to hold the office of president or vice president? Because this is not being talked about on any of the major news talk channels, not even CNN or MSNBC or Fox. Also, I want to make a statement, and that is that libertarianism, if you were to basically crunch it down to its basic philosophy, your typical libertarian does not want to believe that he is connected to other human beings. As someone who is progressive left-wing in his beliefs, I do believe that we are part of one human family and that we have to, not just as individuals, but through the government, work towards social justice and economic justice for other human beings. So, you know, we do have an interdependency with other of our fellow human beings, and the libertarian has developed this extreme mentality that says, I do not want to have to be concerned with what is going on
right.
in the lives
of it's sociopathy. Umberto, it's sociopathy. The Constitution, by the way, says no person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of the Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. And then also you have to be 35 years old. Nobody knows what natural-born means. According to the birthers, natural-born means born in the United States. This has not been litigated. There's never been a challenge to anybody running for president. George Romney ran for president on the Republican ticket in my lifetime. I remember when he was the governor of Michigan, he was running for president, and he was born in Mexico, although both his parents were U.S. citizens. In the case of Ted Cruz, his father was a Cuban citizen at the time that he was born, and he was born, you are correct, in Canada. So, but, you know, the birthers don't care about that because Ted Cruz looks white, whereas Barack Obama doesn't.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, and John McCain was born in Panama, although both his parents were U.S. citizens, and I believe it was on a naval base, so they consider that U.S. territory. But anyhow, it's all about the racism. That's what it's all about. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jay watching Free Speech TV in Galena, Missouri. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I have a question for you on the Social Security. When the Iraq War started, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that President Bush took millions out to fund the war.
He borrowed millions.
He
borrowed billions to pay for the war, yes.
And have they paid any of that back?
No. It's been added to the debt. Our debt has continued to increase. But it wasn't taken out of Social Security, if that was your question. It was the way that the government borrows money is it issues IOUs, and those IOUs are called treasury bonds and treasury bills. And, you know, right now there's about 17 trillion of those IOUs floating around. And people buy those IOUs and use them, you know, other countries buy them, other people use them as an investment because they pay interest. And but it's got nothing to do with Social Security. Social Security is itself, it has a surplus right now of $2.7 trillion. The reason why is because in the second year of the Reagan administration, they decided to, quote, fix Social Security because all this whole huge boomer generation was coming down the road. So they said, okay, up until now, people working had been paying for the retirement of their parents, basically. We're going to make it so that starting in 1982, the boomer generation is going to pay not only for the retirement of their parents, but for their own retirement. So they doubled the Social Security tax, and they created a Social Security surplus fund, the Social Security Trust Fund. That fund would swell up to almost $3 trillion at the peak of the baby boomers working, which is roughly now, you know, over the last 5 years or so. And then it would start to deflate, and it would go back down to zero around 2030 when the last of the baby boomers was dead. And then they would go back to Social Security being funded by people who are working, paying for the retirement of people who are their parents. And, you know, it's worked out pretty reasonable. And that fund has invested that $2.7 trillion in treasuries, in government IOUs. So the conservatives have taken that fact and turned it into a lie. They've said because Social Security has invested its money in treasury bills, and treasuries are IOUs from the government, that's money that the government has spent. Well, it's true. When the government borrows money, it spends it. But the government also pays the money back eventually. And when those treasuries come due, and some of them already have, the ones that Social Security is holding, when they come due, the government pays them back. So there has been no theft from Social Security, if that was your concern. That's what you had expressed to Danielle.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, this was there has been no theft from Social Security. There's $2.7 trillion in treasuries that Social Security is sitting on. George Bush tried to make this into a campaign issue. He went to Virginia where they've actually got the box full of the treasuries, right? And he pulled them out for a camera. He said, look at it, it's just a piece of paper. This is the same George W. Bush who was born with a $1 million trust fund that was invested in treasuries. So according to his logic, the $1 million that he was born with wasn't any good, although he could turn those treasuries in, and treasuries can be turned in any time, and you get different amounts of maturity and things like that. But so there's been no theft in the trust fund, but of our debt right now, about $5 trillion of our debt was run up by George W. Bush, and it was run up because of his tax cut for millionaires and billionaires, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, and the great crash. And that's the bottom line, Jay. Thanks for the call. It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Mary in Seattle, listening on KBCS. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Yes, I was looking through the Internet today. I gave up my cable TV, and so I get most of my news from the Internet now. And there was something very, very interesting I wanted to pass on to you. This is concerning CPI.
Right, the chain CPI, you mean?
Yes, mm-hmm. Right. And this was on the White House. You know, this is coming from them.
Right.
As part of the offer, President was willing to accept Republican proposal to switch to the chain CPI. But the budget makes clear that the openness to change CPI depends on two conditions. The President is open to switching to the chain CPI only if the change is part of a balanced deficit reduction package that includes substantial revenue raised through tax reform. It is coupled with measures to protect the vulnerable and avoid increased poverty and hardship. The budget contains two types of protections, and this all this says then is benefit enhancement for the very elderly and others who rely on Social Security for long periods of time.
Right.
Then it goes on with of different ways to do things for the next 10, 15 years,
I'm familiar with all this, Mary. Is your point that the chain CPI isn't that bad a thing, or is your point that there's no way the Republicans are going to raise taxes, so this is a non-starter, so why are we talking about it, or what?
I feel that, we were promised that a CPI would not be put into effect.
Right.
And, Social Security would not be touched. And this really, I've been a Obama supporter all along, and I saw this, and I was so disappointed.
Yeah, I am too. And Senator Sanders is, and Peter DeFazio is, and there is no need for this. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, here's how a chained CPI works. The reason it's called chained is because it's chaining the cost of living increase to changes in people's behavior. So the theory is everybody eats meat. I don't eat meat. I've been a vegetarian since I was 16. But let's say everybody eats, steak. And steak is, I have no idea what it costs. But let's say it costs $1 a pound. And then times get tough. And so people decide, I can't afford the steak anymore. I'll start eating hamburger, which is only 90 cents a pound. So they go to hamburger. And then they decide, and then times get tough, and they say, I can't afford the hamburger anymore, so I'll switch to chicken, which is only 60 cents a pound. Now, under that formula, the CPI would be calculated based on that change in behavior. So instead of measuring the fact that the cost of steak went from 90 cents a pound to $1 a pound, and therefore the CPI should go up by, 10%, they would say, people's behavior changed. They're eating hamburger now, so we don't need to increase the cost of living. And then when the hamburger price goes up, people start eating chicken. They'd say, people are eating chicken now. And to take it to the absurd logic, people stop eating chicken and they start eating dog food. Oh, people are eating dog food now. We still don't have to raise the cost of living. And that's how the chain CPI works. And it's wrong and it's crazy. And I'm totally with you, Mary. Thank you for the call and thank you for bringing that up. Chad in Wayne, New Jersey, listening on WBAI. Hey, Chad, what's up?
Hey Tom, how are you?
I am great.
I just wanted to comment on your kind of discussion of Ayn Rand within the context of the libertarian movement.
Yes.
I just think so. Ayn Rand is, I think that's a stereotypical attribution to associate those two, just because Ayn Rand is seen as a typical libertarian leader. But I think it's important to remember that the libertarian movement is just as diverse and varied as the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. And, not everybody subscribes to Ayn Rand's particular philosophy.
Well, let me just play you, Chad, what Ayn Rand had to say when she was on 60 Minutes. Here's her comments on the morality of the marketplace.
What's wrong with loving your fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself.
And that was the answer to, do you rescue the person from the river if you see them drowning?
Right.
You have another clip. We have one other clip of Ayn Rand going off on this, and here it is.
You are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Other reviews have said that you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes.
Christ, every important man.
Then he goes on to that. So, Chad, I don't get it. How can you defend that?
Well, that's the thing. I think that's the straw man. Within the libertarian movement, there are a lot, there's a large component of young people. And I think
right. What
is attractive
to them? Who have been seduced
is,
by free pot.
Not necessarily. You could, it's the combination of social freedom with, an anti-war platform that really has been the most consistent out of any party, Republican.
No, the Green Party has been far more consistent about being anti-war than the Libertarian Party, because the Libertarian Party says basically that if the war contractors want to buy politicians, they should have the right to do that and convince those politicians to declare a war. That's all okay.
Well, no, that's within, kind of you're reverting more to a typical framework or a stereotypical assumption of what a libertarian is.
No, this is what Ron Paul has said.
Well, that's the thing. So, these are politicians, and my point is that, at any point in time, politicians can hijack a movement or use it for their own interests. And my point is that there's a large, substantial young component to the Libertarian Party
And Chad, I'm telling you, you have been snookered. You have been snookered. If you want to see how libertarianism works, go to Somalia. There you have a country where all the government does is run the courts and the military, which is, you know, what libertarians say it should be. Somalia is the libertarian paradise. But, Chad, call another time when we've got a little more time. I'd love to have this conversation with you in more depth. And thanks for listening to us on WBAI there in New York City. We'll be back tomorrow with the government shutdown behind us. For now, time to talk to the conservatives about where we go from here. I'll have a conversation with Newt Gingrich. Seriously. I'm going to ask him again, did you really conspire to bring down the president? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. And get over to lasthours.org and check that out. Tag, you're in. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.